Well, I'm thankful for the opportunity to speak today. Although it's technically the Bible class section, I have a problem that I inherited from my dad, and that is long-windedness. So, because of that, I don't think there's going to be time for questions or comments. However, I'd be more than happy to discuss anything in this lesson after the class session. I don't want there to be no discussion at all. I would love to have discussion on this. But to begin, let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians 15. We'll begin in verse 3. We see what Paul has to say and about the gospel. In chapter 15, verse 3, "For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that He was buried, and that He rose again the third day according to the Scriptures." He rose again, Paul tells us. This passage shows the importance of the resurrection. And that's what we'll be discussing today. And when you think about it, today is the Lord's Day. When we refer to the Lord's Day, we refer to the day that Christ rose from the dead. We'll shortly be partaking of the Lord's Supper, commemorating His death for our sins. And His death would have not meant anything if He wasn't able to overcome death by rising from the dead. In verse 17 of 1 Corinthians 15, we're told, "And if Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins." Our faith is futile or useless. So we do need to have assurance for what we believe. We need to have evidence. There's a lot of people that frown upon using evidence for Christianity, but however, one reason is because there's a lot of people that think that God causes some people to believe and causes other people not to believe. So really, there's no reason to provide evidence. It's out of our hands. However, such a belief is unscriptural. It goes against what we actually read in the Bible. Notice 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. This is a verse that a number of us may know from heart, but what it teaches is that if someone asks you a reason for the hope that is in you, don't frown, give a defense. But how can we give a defense if we don't have a defense? If we don't have any reason to believe what we believe, then how can we give a defense to anyone who asks us for a reason? How can we give a reason without a reason? And we see an example of this practice in Acts chapter 17. Turn there with me now to Acts chapter 17. Beginning in verse 22, and we'll see an example of Paul, and let's observe the approach that he uses to heathens, idol worshippers. In verse 22, we read, "Then Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you.'" So Paul uses the fact that they worship even the unknown God to his advantage. He preaches this unknown God to them. So we should observe the approach that he uses, because these people are non-Christians. They're unbelievers. And in verses 24 through 27, he gives kind of a sermon about who God is. In verse 24, he says that God was not made of hands. In verse 26, we're told he created all nations through one blood. And in verse 27, he wants us to seek him even though he's not far away from any one of us. However, he doesn't just tell them about the true God. Verse 27 isn't the last verse. In verse 28, he says, "For the reason why is in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring." So he references Greek poets in verse 28 to establish a point of agreement between him and the unbelievers. They all agree that we are God's offspring. It was actually Epimenides who wrote, "For in you we live and move and have our being." And it was Aratus who wrote, "For we are indeed his offspring." These were non-Christians. They were fellow Greeks, like the people in Athens. And they were actually, what's interesting is, they were actually referring to Zeus, not the God of the Bible. So obviously Paul would disagree with them on which God in particular is the true God. But there's a point of agreement that we are God's offspring. Whichever God it is, we are God's offspring. And then in verse 29, he uses that area of agreement to show which God is the true God. He starts with an area of agreement and then he works from there, verse 29. "Therefore, since we are the offspring of God," since we can all agree on that, "therefore we ought not to think of the divine nature as like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising." In other words, Paul argues that since we come from God and not vice versa, we shouldn't expect the divine to be man-made like idols. If we came from him, then we're actually God-made. God is not man-made. So see, there's actually an area of agreement that he has with them that actually shows their religion, their worldview is false. Since he agreed with them that we are God's offspring, therefore, God should not look man-made. We should actually be God-made, the other way around. Starting from areas of agreement seems like it's a good approach, and that's the approach that we'll use today to show that Jesus really did rise from the dead, and thus that Christianity is true. When you think about it, one thing that's really nice about the argument of the resurrection is that it truly is an argument for Christianity specifically, because no other worldview, whether atheism or Judaism or Islam, no other worldview believes that Jesus rose from the dead. So if we can show that that happened, then that would rule out all the other worldviews, religious or philosophical. So what is the approach for this lesson? What we're going to do is there's kind of two steps that we'll establish. First of all, we'll establish four historical facts about Jesus. These facts are so well evidenced that they could be taught at secular universities. So three of these facts are virtually unanimous among scholarship. Almost no one who's a scholar, regardless of their views, are going to agree that three of these are true. And then there's one fact that not everyone agrees is true, but it's conceded by a tightly gripping majority. So what we're doing is similar to Paul's approach. We're starting with an area of agreement. Regardless of your worldview, almost everyone's going to agree that these four facts we'll look at are true. After that, just like Paul, will then interpret the facts to show that whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. So for the first fact is that there was a man named Jesus who was crucified. His crucifixion is really well evidenced. It's one of the most well-evidenced events in history, that Jesus was crucified. And some sources we have, of course, are the Gospels. We can read these out of our own Bibles. All these references refer to Jesus being crucified. And the reason this is significant is because of the principle of embarrassment. Christian authors would not write that Jesus, the one that they served and worshipped, was crucified and tortured unless it really did in fact happen. The only reason they would have written that he would have gone through all this is because it really did happen. So the Gospels are reliable in this regard. And also, though, in addition to that, even if you didn't consider this enough evidence, we also have ancient non-Christian sources that also say the same thing. So these first four sources aren't hard to read because you could go to them, turn to them even in your own Bibles. However, raise your hand if you have a copy of Josephus's writings. I think two hands. What about Tacitus? Okay, there's still one. Steve Mons has his references. But almost all of us don't, but that's, I guess, why they invented PowerPoint. Because now I can just display them on the screen. Here's what Josephus had to say. Now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, and when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him. So Josephus says that Jesus was condemned to the cross. And as for Tacitus, he said, again, these are non-Christian writers. Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, or Christ, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So the extreme penalty is a euphemism for crucifixion because it was indeed the extreme penalty. And here's what Lucian had to say. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. It was impressed on them by their original lawgivers that they are all brothers from the moment they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his law. So here Jesus is even referred to as the crucified sage. And a fourth source, what benefit did the Athenians obtain by putting Socrates to death, seeing that they received his retribution for it, famine and pestilence? Or the people of Samos by the burning of Pythagoras, seeing that in 1 hour the whole of their country was covered with sand? Or the Jews by the murder of their wise king, seeing that from that very time their kingdom was driven away from them? So again, we see that the wise king being murdered by the Jews. Who else would this be referring to than Jesus? Was Solomon the wise king that was murdered by the hands of the Jews? No, he wasn't. It was Jesus. So we have a number of sources, and really more sources could be given. For example, we could reference Paul's writings or other non-Christian sources, extra-biblical sources, but these definitely should be enough. And by the way, when you think about it, if Jesus really was crucified in history, like we see, then obviously he had to really exist in history to be crucified. There are some people that will, some really big skeptics who will even deny that Jesus existed in the first place, but they're not taken seriously, not even in secular circles. Virtually everyone agrees that Jesus did exist and was crucified. In fact, even John Dominic Crossan of the Jesus Seminar, a liberal seminar, had this to say. Jesus' execution is as historically certain as any ancient event can ever be. It's significant that he's one of the co-founders of the Jesus Seminar because it's considered left of the mainstream. In other words, mainstream scholarship, what you'd get at a university, would be more accepting of things about Jesus than the Jesus Seminar would be. Yet even John Dominic Crossan, one of its co-founders, can't think of anything that's more historically certain than that Jesus was executed. So again, it can be useful to quote unbelievers to show even he agrees this is true. It's similar to when Paul quoted those poets. It's not just something that Christians said about we are the offspring of God. It's also something that even the Greeks agreed is true. So that's what we're doing here. Even unbelievers agree that Jesus was crucified. So that's the first of the four facts we'll be looking at. The next historical fact is that after Jesus was crucified, his tomb was found to be empty. Now, I mentioned that of the four facts, three virtually everyone agrees is true, and one, it's not virtually everyone, but it's still a majority. This is the fact that is the most controversial of the four, but even it is still in pretty much an area of agreement. There was a study that found that 75% of scholars who address whether Jesus' tomb was found empty do accept it as being historical. Although that's not unanimous like with the other three facts, can you believe that still that three-fourths of all the scholars that were surveyed do grant that Jesus' tomb really was found empty? So even this could be taught in secular universities. Here's what the Jewish scholar Giza Vermes, who's a skeptic of Jesus' resurrection, had to say. He said that the only conclusion acceptable to the historian must be that the women found at their consternation not a body but an empty tomb. He agrees that women did find Jesus' tomb to be empty, like we read in the Bible. And he says that's not just something Christians believe. That's the only acceptable conclusion to historians. So there's a number, there's actually quite a few arguments. I forget the number, but there's maybe even like double digits how many arguments scholars have given for the empty tomb, but we'll just look at three today. One argument is the Jerusalem factor. And what this is about is that when Christians began preaching that Jesus was risen from the dead, the first place they preached in was Jerusalem. We read about this in Acts chapter 2, and Tacitus corroborates, because he calls Judea the first source of the evil known as Christianity. Again, he's not a Christian author, but he also corroborates this. The reason why Jerusalem is significant is because it's the very city where Jesus' tomb was located. So let's pretend that this is false. Let's pretend that his tomb was not found empty. Why would Jerusalem, the very place that could prove the resurrection wrong, why would that be where the disciples would go? If the tomb still had Jesus' body in it, the disciples surely would have gone somewhere else to preach his resurrection. This would have been the last place they'd go to. Otherwise, people living close to the tomb could have just looked and found that Jesus' body was still there. So even if you don't believe Jesus rose from the dead, a lot of people do believe that one way or another, the tomb ended up being found empty. A second argument is enemy attestation. All that means is that even the enemies of Christianity at this time didn't deny that the tomb was empty. Even they subtly admitted that it was empty. And to illustrate why this is an argument, let's say that there's a child who tells his suspicious parents that it was someone else who broke in and stole the cookies from the cookie jar. Well, we at least know that the jar must be empty. Otherwise, the kid would have just said, "What are you talking about? See, here are the cookies. They're right here in the jar all along. I didn't steal anything." But since he's making an excuse that someone broke in and stole all the cookies, then we at least know it must be empty because even he's admitting that they're gone. So it's the same thing with the enemies of Christianity. When Christians would proclaim that Jesus was risen from the dead, the enemies would have just replied, "What are you talking about? Look, here's his body in the tomb." That's what they would have said if there was still a body in the tomb anyway. However, in Matthew chapter 28, verses 11 through 15, that's a passage you can write down, we read about them saying that the disciples stole the body. And then at the end of verse 15 of Matthew 28, it says that it is commonly reported to this day. So even to the time that Matthew was written, it was still commonly said among the Jews that the disciples stole the body. They claimed the disciples stole the body. So if Jesus' body was still in the tomb, they would have just said so. So even the enemies back then didn't deny that the tomb was empty. They just reinterpreted the empty tomb. They just said the reason it's empty is because the disciples stole the body. But regardless, there's an area of agreement even back then that the tomb was empty. If they back then, the enemies of Christianity back then agreed the tomb was empty, why shouldn't we also agree about that this is a real historical event? And finally, there's the testimony of women. The reason this is significant is because back at this time, the testimony of women was not considered trustworthy. And it's argued in the Talmud, in fact, that women would be on the same level as gamblers and slaves when it came to testimony. Sorry, ladies, I didn't create that rule, but that's how it was back at this time. So that was how it was in the first century. So let's think about this. The Gospels do teach that the tomb was empty. Can we trust that did they just make it up or not? Well, if they made it up that the tomb was found empty, then that means that they would have also had to have made up the details. Because obviously if you make up a story and it's all false, all your details in the story would also have had to have been made up. But what do we find when we read the Gospels? Turn with me to Luke chapter 23 in verse 55. Let's consider consider in the background how the testimony of women was considered at this time as we read this passage. Notice who the primary witnesses, the original people to find the tomb empty are. Verse 55, and the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. And they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Now on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they and certain other women with them came to the tomb bringing the spices which they had prepared. But they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. Then they went in and did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. So they did not find Jesus' body. The tomb was empty. So Luke says that it was actually women who are the primary witnesses. So the question is, is this telling the truth or did they make it up? It doesn't make sense that they would make up that women were the ones who found the tomb to be empty. Luke and John both record that women were the first ones, and then later we find men. In fact, Matthew and Mark don't even record about men seeing the empty tomb. They record other things, but you don't actually ever read about men seeing the tomb empty in Matthew or Mark. Why would they write this way, considering that at that time women's testimony was not considered trustworthy? The only reason that makes sense that they would say that women were the ones to find the tomb empty is because women really did find the tomb empty. So that's another evidence that the tomb was found empty. So the principle of embarrassment would also support the empty tomb. The only reason they would have said this is if it really did happen, if they really did find a tomb empty. So those are three arguments for the tomb being empty. And again, of the four facts we're looking at, this is the one that's most likely to be challenged. And when I've watched debates about the resurrection and stuff, almost always the passionate atheists do deny the empty tomb, even if they accept the other things. So it is good to have arguments for the tomb being empty. If you want to remember these three arguments, there's kind of a way you can remember it by looking at the first letter of each argument, noticing that they make the acronym JET. And you can see that. I guess there's four lines the way it looks on this slide, but there's three arguments, and the first letters spell out the word JET, so you can remember Jerusalem factor, enemy attestation, and testimony of women. So the reasons for us to believe that it really was real in history if the tomb was empty is that, one, the gospel couldn't have begun in Jerusalem otherwise, since, two, even Christianity's enemies didn't deny it, so why should we? And since, three, the gospels would only have said that women found the tomb empty if women did find the tomb empty. So now we have two different facts. One, Jesus was crucified, and two, that after his tomb was found empty. Now we'll move on to fact number three, and this one is really important. Again, virtually everyone agrees that this is true. No, I haven't seen a debate where atheists would ever deny that this next fact is true, and yet this is a very, very powerful fact, so it's actually shocking. Can you believe, as hard as it is to imagine, you could actually teach in a secular setting that people saw Jesus alive after he was crucified? Yes, you can actually teach that people saw Jesus alive after he was crucified in a secular setting. Now, I know you might be scratching your heads, but look, here is a quote from Germany's leading resurrection critic, Gerd Ludemann. He says, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ." Even he admits this. Now, I'm not pulling your leg. He really is an atheist, and he is Germany's leading critic of the resurrection, but he does believe that they did have experiences in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. Now, of course, he wouldn't admit that they actually saw him risen or that he was actually there to be seen, but he does agree, there's an area of agreement that they sincerely believe they saw Jesus risen from the dead. Maybe they were just hallucinating. That's what he would say, is that maybe they were just hallucinating. But there is an area of agreement that one way or another they did see Jesus risen from the dead. Whether he was there to be seen or he was just hallucinating, there is that area of agreement. And we'll look into whether or not hallucinations actually make sense in a minute. But first, let's consider why they consider this to be the case. A key passage that both skeptic and Christian alike use is 1 Corinthians 15, 5-8. You can see up here on the slide, we're told that Christ was seen by Cephas, then by the 12. After that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remained to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that, he was seen by James, then by all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen by me also, as by one born out of due time. So even here we read that there's appearances to individual disciples, to groups of disciples. Some of these were group appearances, and even to unbelievers. James and Paul were unbelievers from what we can see. And this list here in 1 Corinthians is corroborated by the Gospels and the book of Acts. Also, the appearances were so convincing, what they experienced was so convincing that they sincerely believed that they saw Jesus risen from the dead. It wasn't like just that they kind of think they see someone out in the distance and, yeah, maybe that's Jesus. They sincerely were convinced that they did see Jesus risen from the dead. The reason we know this is because we know from history that they were willing to suffer and die for their belief. You only need to turn to the book of Acts to see what Christians had to go through. And also, there's extra-biblical sources that also support this. And I'm not saying that because they were willing to die for their belief that that proves it in and of itself to be true. The people that did 9/11 believed, sincerely held to their religious beliefs, but that doesn't make them true. What I'm saying, though, is that this wasn't, that what they saw was very clear and made them sincerely believe it. And they weren't being tricked. They didn't sincerely believe because someone told them. They sincerely believed Jesus rose from the dead because of what they themselves saw. And it's amazing that even atheists will agree that this is a real historical fact in history, that a number of Christians, like the ones listed here, actually did become convinced that they saw Jesus risen from the dead, even as groups and even skeptics saw him. So this will be really powerful. But first, let's review the three facts we've looked at. Jesus is crucified. That's the first fact. Then afterward, his tomb is found empty. And all of a sudden, a bunch of people become convinced that they see him risen from the dead. So those are three facts. Now we'll move to the fourth and final fact. And after that, we'll interpret the evidence to show that Jesus rose from the dead. The fourth and final fact is that there was actually a predisposition against such a thing as Jesus rising from the dead. We might think that today that we live in a more, at least in the United States, we live in a more secular culture. So maybe in their culture, maybe it would have just been easy for them to believe that Jesus rose from the dead. But in reality, their religious background served as a further hindrance, not an aid to their new belief, because what they believed about the Messiah actually contradicted what the truth was about the Messiah. So we should actually consider what the belief about the Messiah was at this time. First of all, death would seemingly disprove, because at this time, the Jews expected that the Messiah, or the Christ, would be someone who would come to overthrow the Roman government and establish an earthly kingdom. Because of this, because their goal was to overthrow the Roman government, well then, if they would die by the Romans, that would actually disprove that one was the Christ. Sometimes that someone might claim to be the Messiah, but if they would end up dying by the Romans, and they would say, well, I guess he wasn't the Messiah. So death would actually disprove that someone was the Christ in the Jewish mind at this time. We can see an example of this. This can help us understand why sometimes it didn't seem so obvious to the followers of Christ at this time. Turn to Mark chapter 8, verse 31. Mark chapter 8, verse 31 and 32. Verse 31, "And he, Jesus, began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly." But what does Peter do? Does he say, yeah, that's what we've always thought the Christ would do? No. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. So obviously he didn't understand the whole reason that the Christ would come. In verse 33, Jesus says that he was not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. The Jews at this time did not understand the way the Christ would behave and what his actual purpose was. So we can see why Paul wrote that the concept of the Christ being crucified was to the Jews a stumbling block and to the Greeks foolishness. That's in 1 Corinthians 1:23, but notice Mark chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. Here we find out that they didn't even expect that Jesus would rise from the dead. I guess that makes sense. They didn't expect him to die. They didn't expect him to rise from the dead. But now chapter 9 of Mark, verses 9 and 10. "Now as they came down from the mountain, he commanded them that they should tell no one the things they had seen till the Son of Man had risen from the dead." Again, till the Son of Man had risen from the dead. So they kept this word, verse 10, they kept this word to themselves, questioning what the rising from the dead meant. They didn't even know what he was talking about. They didn't expect that he would rise from the dead. So, again, it's clear they actually had a predisposition against such a thing. And again, this also is an area of agreement that we even have with skeptics. North America's leading resurrection critic, Bart Ehrman, had this to say. He went as far as to say, there was not a Jew on the planet who thought the Messiah was going to be crushed by his enemies. That was the opposite of what the Messiah would do. The Messiah, the Jews thought, was supposed to crush his enemies, not be crushed by them. So again, this is an area of agreement. But even hypothetically, let's say that you don't believe that the Jews had a bias, a predisposition against Jesus' resurrection. you would still have to definitely believe that at least two people did, because they were actually skeptics of Jesus. They weren't even followers of him. Whether you knew what his purpose was as Christ or not, they did not believe he was the Christ to begin with. One of these people is Paul. In Acts chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, we read that, in fact, he wasn't just an unbeliever, he was a persecutor of Christianity. And in Galatians 1, verse 13, a book that Paul himself wrote, a book that everyone agrees Paul wrote, he tells us that he persecuted Christianity, that he persecuted the Church of God. However, we normally think of Paul as being a Christian. We know that he converted in Acts, and in 1 Corinthians 15, you might remember we just read it, he saw Jesus risen. And from that point onward, he changed and he became a follower of Christ. And he's now one of the most well-known Christians of the first century. And he wrote half of the books in the Bible we know about. So he became very significant. And also there's James. Now turn to Mark chapter 3, verse 21. And we kind of see that even Jesus' own brothers did not believe that he was the Christ. Verse 21, but when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. His own people thought that he was out of his mind. This is referring to his family rather than to like fellow Jews, because notice that they're going out to lay hold of him in verse 21. Then when you go down to verse 31, we see who it is that arrived. Remember, they're coming out to lay hold of him. Then his brothers and his mother came, and standing outside, they sent to him calling him. So it was his family who came out thinking that he might be out of his mind. We read in other passages that his own brothers did not believe that he was the Christ. However, you might remember in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 7, that there was a James who saw the Christ risen. This was Jesus' brother. And all of a sudden later, now when we read in the Bible in later passages, we read of James, the brother of Jesus, as being a Christian. So it appears that he also saw Jesus risen from the dead, and because of that, converted and became a follower. So obviously there were people who were skeptics of Jesus, but who converted upon seeing him. So because of this, now we have four different facts that pretty much everyone agrees is true about Jesus, which is that he was crucified, that his tomb was found empty, and that people saw him alive, became convinced that they saw him alive after his crucifixion, and that there was a predisposition against thinking that he could rise from the dead. Now, we might remember what Paul did. He started with an area of agreement in Acts 17:28, and then in verse 29, he moved from there to show that Christianity is true. Now we're going to do kind of the verse 29. Now we're going to use these facts to show that Jesus rose from the dead. And when historians try to determine what's true in history and what's not, they look at certain qualifications or criteria to determine whether something should be considered historical or non-historical. One person who literally wrote the book on this process, C.B. McCullough, he lists seven different criteria to determine whether your theory best explains what we know. So in this case, our theory would be that Jesus rose from the dead, the resurrection theory. And the facts we have are the four ones. I guess I can go back. These four facts: that Jesus was crucified, his empty tomb, his appearances, and the predisposition against his resurrection. So the qualifications that he says to look at are, one is explanatory scope. Some of these terms might sound kind of fancy, but don't get bogged down. They're not complicated. All this means is that your theory should actually be trying to explain the facts. And Jesus' resurrection does attempt to explain the fact. It explains why his tomb would be empty, and it explains why both follower and skeptic alike could see him alive afterward. And it also explains how their understanding of the views in the Messiah were transformed. How could their views of who the Christ would be, how could it get transformed considering the predisposition? Well, if he actually did rise from the dead, that would explain it. But also, a theory shouldn't just have explanatory scope, where your theory has the scope covering the ones. It also should have explanatory power. It should explain the evidence well. It qualifies when a certain explanation makes the fact we know highly likely. So it's almost like, let's pretend we don't have these four facts. We don't know whether they're true. All we know is that Jesus rose from the dead, kind of the reverse. Would we be able to think, well, these four facts probably are true just because Jesus rose from the dead? Does Jesus' resurrection explain why all these things could happen really well? And it does. It explains why we'd expect that his tomb would be found empty if he rose from the dead. I mean, I don't think that he'd be staying in the tomb all that time if he rose from the dead. He'd probably go out. And it would explain why people would see him, become convinced they saw him alive, because he really was there to be seen. It would also explain how even skeptics could see him risen. It's not just in their mind like a hallucination. And it explains how they would really believe it, even if it were against their predisposition, their religious views. Also, though, a theory should be plausible. And what that means is that it should be probable based on accepted truths we know about the world. And although an accepted truth we do know about the world is that people who die don't rise from the dead naturally, that doesn't disconfirm that Jesus could rise from the dead supernaturally. So if we, with the Christian worldview, if we believe in God, then that would make probable Jesus' resurrection. But of course, there's a problem. If we're trying to convince an unbeliever, then denying God's existence would do just the opposite. Then the theory would be implausible. So if you're talking to an atheist, we won't be able to agree on what truths to accept. But although they disagree with us that God exists, we disagree with them when they say that nature is all that exists. So we can actually just go neutral here. We can assume neither that God exists nor that he does not exist. And then the resurrection theory would be neither plausible nor implausible. And that's okay. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes a theory can be neither plausible nor implausible because your worldview is what determines it. So also, and this is probably the most complicated sounding one, this next one, ad hocness. All that means is that your theory should not be ad hoc, which means that what C.B. and McCullough says is that your theory can't require many new suppositions about the past, which are not already implied to some extent by existing belief. The dumbed down version is, keep it simple, stupid. All it means is that your theory, in order for your theory to be true, you shouldn't have to start assuming a bunch of stuff about the past that you don't already know to be true. You shouldn't have to say, well, okay, this is true and that is true, just to make your theory fit. And Jesus' resurrection, all that you have to assume is that he died when he was crucified and that he was alive after he was crucified. Because if he died when he was crucified and then he was alive at some point later, then he must have risen from the dead. And these are implied by existing beliefs. We believe that he died when he was crucified because, well, he was crucified. Let's just say he wasn't given a slap on the wrist. The Journal of the American Medical Association agrees that modern medical interpretation of the historical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead when taken down from the cross. And we can believe that he was alive afterward because tons of people saw him alive. So the theory is not ad hoc. Finally, a theory should have relative superiority. This means that just because these four facts, the resurrection theory is good with, doesn't necessarily mean it's true. What if there's another theory that ties with it or is almost as good? Then it'll be more fuzzy. So relative superiority says if you're going to believe the theory, it better stand out as being superior to the other ones. So there's a lot of other theories, too, that atheists and other skeptics have given to explain why these four facts could be true. And just to kind of outline them really quickly, one that we talked about is the hallucination theory, which is that they just hallucinated. See, here's the resurrection, and it has explanatory scope, power, plausibility, and it's not ad hoc. Well, it's neutral plausibility. The hallucination theory does not have explanatory scope because it doesn't try to explain as many facts as the resurrection does. It's mainly just trying to explain how could they see Jesus risen. It has nothing to do with the empty tomb. How did the tomb get empty? And if it doesn't have explanatory scope, it obviously doesn't have explanatory power either. We wouldn't expect all the facts just from hallucinating. And it's also implausible. What we know about the world goes against that hallucinations could happen to skeptics, because a hallucination is where your mind produces the image of something that's not really there. How could this happen to skeptics if they don't even have it in their mind that Jesus rose from the dead? It also goes against groups. If I think I see an object in front of me and no one else sees it, I'm hallucinating. If I think I see an object in front of me and everyone else also sees it in a group, that means it's really there to be seen. So if they were just hallucinating Jesus, they couldn't see him in groups. Otherwise, he'd really be there to be seen. And the Navy SEALs actually help support this, because in order to become a SEAL, you have to go through a week of intense exercises and stress for only 3 to 5 hours of sleep. You have only 3 to 5 hours of sleep for a week of training. It's not surprising that hallucinations occur. And several SEALs were interviewed, and they said that hallucinations are most common when they're paddling in a raft as a crew, in other words, in a group out in the ocean. One person thought he saw an octopus rise from the water and wave at the crew, but when he pointed it out to the others, no one else saw it. He's hallucinating, so the group couldn't see it. Another person thought he saw a train coming through the water about to run into them, but again, no one else could see it. Another person thought he saw a wall and that they were going to crash into it, maybe like what happened on the Titanic. However, whenever one person would show the others, no one else could see it. It was just hallucinating. However, I don't see anything making the hallucination theory ad hoc. They're not assuming a bunch of stuff that we don't already know. So then there's a modified version, because see, this doesn't look very good. 3 X's and 1 check. So they have the stolen body and hallucination. Now they're at least trying to explain everything, because the tomb, they're saying the tomb was empty because the body was stolen, and they hallucinated, and that's how they saw Jesus. However, we still don't have explanatory power, because we wouldn't know. It wouldn't explain how groups or skeptics could see Jesus, and it's implausible for the same reason. This version actually is ad hoc, because now we're starting to assume a bunch of stuff. We're assuming that they hallucinated, and we're assuming that the body was stolen. And then here are the fun theories. The twin theory is that, well, maybe Jesus had a twin that no one knew about, and all of a sudden he just pops up on the scene pretending to be Jesus risen from the dead. When they see the twin, they think it's Jesus. Well, this does have explanatory scope and explanatory power, because what they'll say is that the twin stole Jesus' body and then pretended to be the real Jesus. However, it's very ad hoc, because it assumes that Jesus even had a twin, and then it also assumes that no one else knew about the twin. Otherwise, they would just know it's the twin. And the swoon theory is the theory that Jesus actually survived crucifixion and he just fainted or was swooned instead. This theory doesn't make sense either, because if Jesus just fainted instead of died, well, that goes against what we know about science. Remember that quote, "Modern medical interpretation of the historical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead when taken down from the cross. And it seems ad hoc that he'd be able to roll away the tomb, walk away bleeding, and somehow survive all that." So none of these theories are actually that good. You can see the resurrection is far superior to the other theories that man has come up with. So, because of that, the resurrection theory does have relative superiority, and it should be considered true. So the facts that scholars, even secular ones, grant us, those four facts, imply that the resurrection really did happen when using the methods that historians use. So if you're feeling bogged down, because this was a lot of information that we just covered, then here's basically the case in a nutshell of what happened. If you can just remember this little nutshell, then I'll feel like that I've done my job. Remember that Jesus was crucified, and that virtually everyone agrees this was true because that shows that he died. What we know about science is that you don't survive crucifixion. And remember that people saw Jesus alive, were convinced they saw, even in group settings, and skeptics saw Jesus alive, because that shows that he was alive after his death. And if they actually saw him alive in group settings, and we all agree that's true, they weren't hallucinating, because if everyone sees it in a group, he was really there alive to be seen. And so if he died when he was crucified, and then he was alive 1 point later, then what happened in between? Obviously, he rose from the dead in between. So if even really just with these two facts, you can show that Jesus rose from the dead. But there's also the extra evidence. If you want, you can remember that. The empty tomb, again, not everyone agrees it's true, so you'll have to defend it. And if there was a predisposition against Jesus' resurrection. But especially remember this one, and point one and point two. Those are the most significant. So they cannot both be true, that Jesus survived crucifixion, or that Jesus died when he was crucified and that he was alive later, unless he really did die. So the evidence shows that Jesus rose from the dead. I thank you for your time.
Oh, you are a preacher.
Taking college. Good job. Excellent. Good job. This
Thank
for you.
Thank you.
You're very well.
Very good lesson. Very
Thanks
good.
A lot.
You do a good job.
Thank you, Toby.
He's going to be putting you out of a job, Bryce.
Nice job. Nice.
Thanks, Steve.
Good job.
It was 52 minutes.
Yeah, we got 5 minutes before we start worship.
Okay, sorry.
The beginning of it, you can reduce that by being more specific, and then that way you'd have more time on the end. In the beginning, you can't repeat things too much. That's okay. The only thing I would say. You got to be conscious of the clock, because we got it plugged in, and we got to get going.
I understand.
It's a hard line.
Yeah. I actually did start going just from the charts at the very end.
Yeah, you need to do that.
But,
in the beginning.
Yeah.
You started, you started talking quicker. That's it.
So.
Thank you.
So here, is it? Did I get it to stop?